Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Christian Studies. I'm your host, Ryan Shelton, and today we're joined by Dr. John G. Turner, author of the new book, They Knew They Were Pilgrims, Plymouth Colony and the Contest for American Liberty, just published in 2020 by Yale University Press. Thanks so much, John, for joining us.
Pleased to be with you, Ryan.
Well, John, I'm really excited to get into this book with you, but before we dive in, could you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. Well, I live just outside the Beltway in Northern Virginia, and I teach at George Mason University. I've been there for about 8 years. I have appointments in the departments of religious studies and history. I have a PhD from the University of Notre Dame. I also have a Master's of Divinity from Louisville Presbyterian Theological Seminary. I love teaching, researching, writing, and talking about the role of religion in the history of American culture and politics. First book I wrote was about American evangelicalism, specifically Campus Crusade for Christ. I've also written some things on the Latter-day Saints. And you can tell that I have lots of interests. The history of American religion is just so full of fascinating stories. I'm not gonna live long enough to get to all of them that I want to learn about.
Well, John, you wrote your book, They Knew They Were Pilgrims, just in time for the 400th anniversary of the Mayflower Landing. Of course, this is a subject that's been written about so much. I would be curious to hear from you. What were some of your unique approaches, some of the things that you were trying to do to contribute to this study of the Plymouth Separatists?
Well, Ryan, I think in part because Americans have placed so much weight on the story of the Mayflower and turned it into a national origins myth. And many Americans still associate the eventual, founding of their country. They root it in the landing on Plymouth Rock. Precisely because of that, it's important for historians to go back, to freshly examine it, and to get that story as right as possible, and to look at it from new angles. So, that was part of my motivation. I did hope that, because it was the 400th of the Mayflower Crossing and the Mayflower Compact and the landing at Plymouth, I hope that would maybe induce more people to read the book.
Yeah.
But also for me, as I got into the research, one thing that really struck me is that, Americans, they often have a smattering of knowledge about the Mayflower and the first Thanksgiving. And historians who write about the settlement and colonization of New England, they always discuss those early Plymouth events. And then Plymouth Colony pretty much disappears from the story once the Massachusetts Bay colonists show up starting in 1628. And because Massachusetts Bay was larger, had more economic and military clout, that colony tends to really dominate the story of early New England. And Plymouth only reappears around 1675 with King Philip's War, which began in Plymouth and then engulfed all of New England. And there was, you know, I found there's a really fascinating half century of history, you know, between the first Thanksgiving and King Philip's War, and some remarkable stories about New England settlements and New England natives that have gotten a lot less attention, but are also very gritty, colorful, and illuminating parts of early New England history.
You've talked a little bit about this group that came on the Mayflower as distinct from the Massachusetts Bay Colony. So are these the Puritans? Are they somehow distinct from the Puritans? And so who were these pilgrims and in the separatists, as you refer to them in your book?
Sure, that's a great question. You know, sometimes people draw a sharp distinction between pilgrims and Puritans. Other people more or less lump them together. This is how I think about it. So the Puritans were English Protestants who wanted to further purify the Church of England. The term Puritan was really a derogatory term that their opponents used for them, suggesting they were too focused on creating a pure church. And Puritans had all sorts of complaints about the Church of England. You know, they didn't think many elements of ceremony and worship were biblical. They didn't like everything from the sign of the cross at baptism to the priestly garments that Church of England ministers wore that resembled Catholic priestly garments a little bit too much. So they had all sorts of complaints. Most Puritans didn't break from the Church of England. They hoped to purify it from within. The most radical of the Puritans decided that they were obliged to immediately separate from it and form their own covenanted congregations. Those were the separatists who eventually comprised the majority of passengers on the Mayflower. There were some other folks who joined the venture as well, who bought into it. Probably about a third of the passengers were not, of the adult passengers were not separatists. So it was a bit of a motley crew. But at its core, the Mayflower crossing intended to transplant a congregation to the New World. A lot of the separatists, when they were persecuted or feared being persecuted, had left England in the first decade of the 1600s and had taken refuge in the Netherlands, in particular under the leadership of a minister named John Robinson in the Dutch city of Leiden. And it was from there that the Mayflower venture began. For a variety of reasons, a portion of the congregation didn't want to stay in the Netherlands any longer. They wanted somewhere they could prosper a little bit more, where their children would grow up speaking English rather than Dutch, and they decided to start a colony, and that's how we get to the story of the Mayflower and Plymouth.
So, John, once these pilgrims arrive, they didn't arrive in a place that had been entirely, it wasn't unsettled, and they weren't the first people to come from the old world to this new world. So could you tell us a little bit about the early encounter with the indigenous populations, and what was their relationship with the Native Americans like, and how was that maybe different from some of the other European settlers that had already made their way over?
Well, that's almost, in many ways, that's the question that I think animates a lot of discussion and debate about Plymouth Colony and other settlements today, and for good reason. It's not a simple question to answer. I think the first thing that people should know is that you know, the Mayflower arrived in the wake of a terrible and devastating epidemic that had afflicted the native communities of what's now southeastern Massachusetts. Peoples that are generally called Naussets on the Cape, Wampanoags on the island south of the Cape, and in much of southeastern Massachusetts, Pocanokets further to the west. These communities had just been devastated by this epidemic over the previous several years. Some places were almost entirely wiped out, including Patuxet, which was the native name for what became the town of Plymouth. So when the pilgrims came ashore, they saw a lot of evidence of native societies. They saw cornfields, they saw a lot of graves, they saw houses. They didn't see a lot of people at first because, they first explored Cape Cod. The natives on the Cape, the Naussets, they were very wary of these newcomers. And that wasn't first and foremost because of the epidemic. It was because they'd had some other mixed encounters with Europeans. Particularly over the last 20 years, English fishermen, traders, explorers had been coming to the New England coast. And some of those encounters went well. There was trading. There were some occasional, eating together and sort of checking each other out. But some of those encounters had turned violent. In particular, an English ship captain about 6 years before the Mayflower had kidnapped more than 20 native men and women from Patuxet and from the Cape, and had taken them to Spain and sold them as slaves. One of those kidnapped men and would-be slaves was a man named Tisquantum, or Squanto, who really remarkably made it back to his homeland, found it wiped out by this epidemic, and then was among those natives who had some facility with English, who played a pivotal role in the early Plymouth settlement. So that's a long way of saying that when the pilgrims show up, there's a lot of pre-existing mistrust and suspicion. So you would think that the Wampanoags would simply want to wipe out this new threat. But their numbers had been devastated by the epidemic. Some of their traditional enemies had been largely spared to this point. And so the Pocanoket leader, Usamequin, pilgrims called him Massasoit, which means great, great leader. You know, he sized up the situation and decided that the English would be valuable allies. And he was right. It really bolstered his leadership and the ability of Wampanoag and Pocanoket communities to defend themselves. So he and pilgrim leaders form an alliance and a mutual defense treaty. That roughly holds for about half a century. You know, at first, it's a situation or it's an agreement that really benefits both sides. Over the long run, it really works to the benefit of the English. And as the English population grows, especially after the first 10 years of the colony, the English really overwhelm native communities. They, you know, they press in against them. They coerce native leaders to sell land. And when these communities finally resist, the result is a bloody war, which is very costly for the English. King Philip's War, it's usually called. But it's ultimately devastating for those native communities who fight the English. So it's a long story. I don't think it's necessary to depict the Pilgrims as, you know, bloodthirsty invaders. You know, they were sort of religious refugees looking for, somewhere they could, transplant themselves. Both peoples are really looking to their own self-interest and self-preservation. Over time, this is just a devastating chain of events for Native communities.
John, you've mentioned that these were religious refugees, and one of the strengths of your book, I think, is that you really give us some helpful insight into the religious nature of this group of settlers. There's a fascinating observation, a little anecdote that you draw out, how this group had been without their minister, who remained in the Netherlands, John Robinson, for a long time, and were led by their lay elder, William Brewster. But as a result, they hadn't taken the sacraments for quite a long time. And then when another Puritan minister, John Lyford, makes his way over to the colony, they seem to prefer to continue to go without the sacraments, which meant so much to them, rather than to compromise some of their separatist convictions. So can you tell us a little bit about some of that that dynamic and what that tells us about their religious culture, and then a little bit about how then this group of religious refugees interacted with other dissenting religious groups that they encountered?
Sure. Well, it's a great question, and you're right. I mean, Plymouth Colony is in many ways a testimony to the significance of lay leadership among separatists, maybe among Puritans more generally. Their minister, John Robinson, stayed behind in the Dutch Republic because a majority of the congregation stayed there, and so it made sense for him to remain behind as well. And so Plymouth Colony didn't have a minister for its first 10 years. As you mentioned, their elder, William Brewster, preached most regularly, but we also know that other individuals, other lay people, laymen, also preached. Robert Cushman, for instance, comes to the colony briefly in 1621, preaches a sermon. It's published back in England. And he was a grocer and a wool comber in Leiden, a grocer in England, a wool comber in Leiden. And other Puritans, you know, they mock Plymouth Colony for having these ordinary, unlettered, unordained people, be their sermonizers. You know, it's considered something of a scandal. But the separatists have a tradition of defending the right of laymen and sometimes lay women to interpret and teach from the Bible with authority. They called it prophesying, which for them didn't mean making predictions about the future, but, you know, so that authoritative teaching and interpretation of scripture, which they would often do in an afternoon meeting subsequent to Sunday morning worship. But lay leadership did have some drawbacks. John Robinson clarified for the Plymouth colonists that Brewster was not able to baptize children or to preside over the Lord's Supper. And so the colonists simply didn't have those things for the first 9 years or so of the colony. And on the one hand, it wasn't really a grave theological problem, because they didn't believe that children needed to be baptized or individuals needed to be baptized in order to attain salvation. And they didn't see the Lord's Supper as an essential, as essential to human salvation either, but it didn't mean that those things were unimportant to them. And it was, at the very least, a glaring and awkward absence from the colony's religious life. You had children who were born on the ship or during the first several years of the colony. They were unbaptized, and parents weren't happy about it. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned John Lyford, who's a Puritan minister that the financial backers of the colony send over in 1625. And the Pilgrim leaders, they sort of size him up, you know, or, you know, can you go along with our principles? And, you know, he sounds sort of repentant about having been mixed up in the Church of England and in its corrupt ceremonies. But when the rubber hits the road, he won't disavow his ordination in the Church of England. And so that sort of courtship between congregation and prospective minister breaks down, and the relationship becomes really bitter. The Pilgrims kick him out of the colony, becomes a big hubbub on both sides of the Atlantic. And they have a hard time getting a minister to their liking. William Brewster really remains their foremost religious leader for their first couple of decades. You also asked how, in general, they got along with other sorts of dissenters. And the Lyford episode suggests not that well. On the one hand, the Pilgrims did sincerely believe that individuals should have a certain amount of liberty of conscience. They weren't going to force people to join their church. They wouldn't have wanted them all. You know, didn't think they were all fit to be church members. They didn't force anybody to have their children baptized or to partake of the Lord's Supper, as was the case in the Church of England that they had left behind. And for the most part, they don't enforce church attendance. There's some back and forth on that. But if people want to show up and more or less do their own thing, as long as they don't make a public stand against the separatist or congregational church, you know, they can sort of remain aloof from it. But they don't think that people should be able to form competing churches or other religious options. And that really becomes a point of controversy when the Society of Friends or Quakers show up in New England starting in 1656. These are folks who are not content just to quietly, you know, go about their business. Instead, they publicly denounce the colony's political and religious leaders. And for that, they are fiercely persecuted. It's most infamous in Massachusetts, where several Quakers are executed. It doesn't come to that in Plymouth, but they do imprison, fine, whip, and banish Quakers. Then, after a couple of years, conclude it's just impossible to stamp out the Quakers through those harsh methods. And over the last several decades of the colony, the Quakers and Baptists are able to carve out a large measure of religious liberty and toleration in Plymouth Colony.
So, John, I'm curious how up until this point throughout this story that you've been telling, Plymouth is an autonomous, self-ruling colony. But as we get through the King Philip's War period and into the restoration of the monarchy, this doesn't last. So could you talk a little bit about what caused the eventual merging of Plymouth and Massachusetts Bay and that ends this unique chapter of separatist self-rule?
Sure, it's a good question. Well, first of all, I think it's useful to think of Plymouth Colony as sort of a middle ground between Rhode Island and Massachusetts Bay. And, you know, those are two very starkly opposing religious and political visions. Roger Williams, who briefly is a preacher in Plymouth Colony. He is most during his early years in New England, he's mostly in Salem, Massachusetts, and they kick him out, and he eventually becomes the founder of Rhode Island. And Williams comes to believe in soul liberty, that civil government should in no way intrude on the liberty of the human soul. And so there really is a strict separation of church and state in Rhode Island. And it becomes a haven for dissenters of many sorts over time, different sorts of Puritans, Quakers, Baptists, and so forth. Massachusetts Bay ends up with a pretty strict congregational establishment and a substantial amount of cooperation among those congregations and with the colonies, political government. Plymouth Colony is sort of in between. There's not as strong of an establishment. There is an established congregational church in each town. You know, there's not as much outright, you know, cooperation among those congregations or between them and the colony's political leaders. As your question suggested, that's quite right. Plymouth Colony is self-governing from 1620 through 1691. And basically on the foundation established by the Mayflower Compact. And, you know, that's no small accomplishment by the standards of the 17th century to set up a political order that persists for seven decades. You know, I think that's an impressive legacy. In the end, Plymouth Colony is pretty small compared to Massachusetts Bay in particular. It doesn't have a royal charter, which the Bay Colony had and which Rhode Island and Connecticut both obtain. Now, a charter is no guarantee because what the king can grant, the king or another king can take away, and that happens to Massachusetts Bay in the 1680s. You know, there's general thoughts on the other side of the Atlantic that perhaps it would be better to consolidate some of the New England colonies and place them under royal appointed governors. There's a lot of twists and turns to the story, but eventually Plymouth Colony is attached to a larger province of Massachusetts Bay. And Plymouth's leaders, some of them were very simpatico with the Bay Colony's religious establishment and were probably okay with that. There were a lot of Quakers and Baptists, particularly in the western portion of the colony, who very much lamented being attached to the Bay Colony because for them it meant a decided loss of religious toleration and and liberty. They would have preferred to have been attached to another colony such as New York. So Plymouth Colony disappears as a self-governing entity in the early 1690s.
Fascinating. Well, John, thank you so much for the generosity of your time to talk with us about They Knew They Were Pilgrims. It's a great read. I hope our listeners pick it up and enjoy it as much as I did. Before we let you go, could you tell us a little bit about what you're working on next?
Sure, Ryan. Well, thanks again for having me. It's fun to chat with you. Great questions. My next project is a biography of the Latter-day Saint or Mormon prophet Joseph Smith. So I'll be working on that for the next few years.
Excellent. Looking forward to watching how that project develops. Well, once again, we've been talking with Dr. John G. Turner, author of They Knew They Were Pilgrims, Plymouth Colony and the Contest for American Liberty, available now from Yale University Press. Thanks so much for joining us, John.
Thanks, Ryan.
And thank you for listening to New Books in Christian Studies. To find out more about our podcast, go to our website at newbooksnetwork.com And of course, if you enjoy this podcast, we invite you to rate and like and subscribe and share the word with your friends. That's it for now. I hope you have a great day.